That's unusual.
Table's small.
Thanks, Mark. So today we're here to talk about software protection mechanisms in open source operating systems. And we're going to have a type of panel discussion. We've got on my left here is Marius Eriksson, who's soon to be working at Google and has done a lot of work both in Linux and OpenBSD. And on my right here is Matt Fanto, who works for National Institute of Standards and Technology and has done a lot of work with SE Linux and cryptography and such. So we're going to talk about a lot of different software protection mechanisms and different ways they've been done and pluses and minuses to each of those. I'd like to encourage anyone to ask questions. This is going to be a discussion type of format, not a lecture. So please ask questions. Which of you would like to go first in talking about the ideas behind it? You want to go?
Sure.
Do you want to go back and forth or just talk?
Right. Well, can you hear me without the microphone?
We're recording, so use the mic.
Oh, you're recording. Okay. So first of all, why do we need why do we need to protect ourselves? Essentially, the way Unix was designed, it's a very coarse-grained access model. So for example, the whole having root, it's either everything or nothing. And then it turns out that we need privileges for certain tasks, for example, like getting PTYs or raw sockets, or writing to the password file that normal users may want to do. And in doing so, we open ourselves to many, many vulnerabilities because of this coarse-grained access model. So that's sort of one of the motivations. The other motivation is, we really suck at writing code, and if we can protect ourselves in some sort of more generic way than just relying on writing good code, that's also a good thing. Of course, you can say, use a type-safe language and everything will probably be okay. The problem is that 99% of open source software is not written in a type-safe language, and we have to actually deal with these problems. I don't know if you have any.
Yeah. Well, to iterate his second point, and I think this is one area where, well, OpenBSD, they make the claim that there's only been, is it one remote root exploit in the kernel? And I think often people perceive this as being the great measure of security, but in reality, as he said, you can't write bug-free code. It doesn't matter how hard you try. So there's going to exist exploits. It's just a matter of actually finding them. And this is why access control mechanisms are needed, because there is going to be eventually another buffer overflow found in OpenBSD, and it's a matter of mitigating the damages done by that or preventing it altogether. So.
Yeah, another sort of interesting point is also when you run third-party software that you don't necessarily have the source for or can audit in any way. These are becoming more common. You have no idea. You have no sort of trust relationship with the vendor of this software product. And if you can somehow guarantee that the binary you run from this vendor can only do certain things instead of just letting it run as root or even as your own user and read your data, that's also something that would be very convenient to accomplish. And that's also another, I think, important point of software protection mechanisms. So if you want to sort of go over the major... major types of mechanisms that we employ today.
Well, you want to start off with the design philosophy. Well, not the way each OpenBSD and Linux view security.
In reality, that's irrelevant because you can implement anything anywhere and. It just turns out that there are some Linux projects that go for extensive fine-grained access control lists versus, but there are also Linux products like PAX which do other things. So I don't think that's really a sort of relevant point.
Not just. I don't just mean in, additional patches available to the operating system, but as we were talking before and. Rick thought it'd be interesting to bring up SE Linux, for example, and one of the new I guess, security features of the 2.6 version of the Linux kernel. 2.6 now includes what's called Linux security modules, and these are hooks that modules can take advantage of to perform various... The intention of it was to perform access, fine-grained access control and auditing. And it was a battle from day one to get these hooks into the Linux kernel. Linus Torvalds said what he would accept, and after getting that, they worked on the LSM project, but it was a fight to get each one of these hooks in, because some of the bigger developers like Andrew Morton won't take any sort of performance hit if it means a little better security. And I think that's where OpenBSD excels, is that it seems to me, at least, that Theo and the other OpenBSD developers won't make that sacrifice. So
I can continue to comment. OpenBSD, they tend to have a lot of focus on making things that are usable for system administrators, for like the average system administrator, and secure out of the box. So they put a lot of effort into coming up with not only secure policies and such, but also coming up with systems that can have a secure policy that'll work for most people. So one of the problems with SE Linux that you'll get into is that it's hard to come up with a generic policy that works for multiple people. And Theo and the OpenBSD, a lot of the OpenBSD guys will kind of view that as a shortcoming of it, is that the generic policy doesn't exist. Not just that it's hard to make a policy, but it's hard to make one that can be used by multiple people, that it always has to be customized. They like to be able to have a box that they can just turn on and run, and a security feature that makes it harder to do that is a negative in their view.
Yeah, sure. So we mentioned briefly fine-grained access control list, which I believe is what most of SE Linux implements. And what this is essentially, you can assign an access control list essentially to an entity, or where an entity can be, for example, what your user is allowed to do, or even down to what a program can do. So you can say, binls can only, or Emacs can only read and write files out of, slash temp, or Emacs is not allowed to exec a shell, things like that. And these are explicit access control entries that you have to, that the system administrator preferably has to set. And that's a very, it's a very intensive process to actually refine these access control lists to do what you want, because, as you can imagine, depending on how finely grained it is, there's a lot of parameters which you can essentially set. So it's a very high overhead for a system administrator to actually create these access control lists. Another class of software protection mechanisms that has emerged recently is what's called address space randomization. And this is where you essentially just sort of confuse a potential intruder by randomizing things in your address space. So for example, if you can randomize everything that malloc returns. So if you allocate a page and free the page, and next time you allocate a page of the same size, it's not going to be at the same address. And all of these things are designed essentially to make buffer overflows very hard to do. That together with what's called write XOR execute in OpenBSD, and what PAX achieves in Linux, is to essentially say that no page in memory is allowed to be write and execute at the same time, which means that if the processor is allowed to execute code that resides in a page, that program is not allowed to write any information to that same page. And this is essentially what buffer overflows work, because if you buffer overflow, you have to actually write the code into somewhere and then try to jump to that code that you wrote. And so that's designed to forego those kinds of attacks. Page is just a basic unit of memory. So essentially, this is how you address address memory, for example, like your in cache, for example. It'll retrieve pages versus finer grained units like bytes or bits. And all the memory management is also in terms of pages.
Yeah. I don't know. One thing with respect to pages is, at least with Linux, I don't know about, I would imagine, OpenBSD, is there's actually three different types of, I don't know the word to use. Pages are the physical unit of memory. Then, if that makes sense, then you have linear addresses and logical addresses. And,
oh, but they're still pages.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, they still, so, I don't know if it's even worth commenting on. Okay. all right, so.
Well, we can go into some specific ones.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Okay.
I can start if you want to.
Well, I can talk a little bit about SysTrace because I've done a lot of work on it.
So, here. Yeah. I'm going to do a quick intro. So, now we're going to talk about the two major types, as he mentioned, are the access control list, which requires setting some kind of policy or list of what's allowed and what's not, and then the what I'll call the user invisible ones that just kind of work behind the scenes, like PAX and write WXRX, PrivSep, things like that, that users don't have to change the system the way it depending on how it works. So first we'll start with the policy-based or the access control list-based ones. And the couple major ones for that I can think of, obviously SE Linux, Matt's specialty, is a good example of that. It requires a bunch of policies to specify what that's available. And another one, what Marius has done a lot of work on, is SysTrace, which is a policy which allows you to set policies on system calls. So SysTrace was originally developed in OpenBSD and has since been ported by Marius to Linux also. Sure. So we'll let there's a
trade-off start.
Yeah. Now we'll start to get into how they work and what are some of the trade-offs that the implementers made in deciding to do things the way they did. So we'll let Matt start on PAX and or not on SE Linux and policies for that.
Okay. I talked briefly about this in my talk yesterday on SE Linux. Just a quick overview. SE Linux is a project of the SE Linux is a project of the National Security Agency. It has been included by default in the Linux 2.6 series of the kernel. Basically, as Marius hinted at earlier, there's problems with discretionary access controls, which is essentially what Unix permissions are. Discretionary access controls, basically permissions are at the discretion of the user. This leads to a whole lot of problems. The second issue is that of the super user and the all-or-nothing privileges. So these are what mandatory access controls attempt to solve. Permissions are mandatory, there's no way to subvert them, and it's policy files are enforce these, and it takes away the user's ability to give, if too much permission isn't the word, but it takes away permissions based on the discretion of the user. So what SE Linux does is every process runs in a domain and every file is assigned a type. And through these policy files that are pre-written, it controls what domains can access what types. It controls essentially what processes can and can't do and what users can and can't do. And through this, you can not only you have true privilege separation in that if a process is compromised, policy files won't let it affect any other program. If Apache, for example, is running as root on a normal system and it's compromised and a shell is executed, this shell runs as root and has full access to the system. If Apache, again, is running as root with SE Linux and it's compromised, it's still restricted to the Apache domain, and policy files won't allow anything in the Apache domain to do anything except read Apache configuration files and read Apache website files. So you have true privilege separation with that. And one way to actually look at SE Linux is and mandatory access controls, I guess, is to it treats it as though the system has actually been compromised, and SE Linux doesn't do anything to prevent compromises of software. Well, I guess it does place some restrictions that make compromising services more difficult, but it really doesn't do anything. It doesn't go out of its way to protect against it. It's more that when a service is actually compromised or when a user has access to your machine, it controls what he can and can't do and the damages he can inflict. So if there's anything else you want to say on that.
How fine-grained control is
it? It's extremely fine-grained control. You can assign any number of files, any resources, any sockets, any files, different types, and you can control. You don't just give it read permissions. Read permissions mean a lot more than just reading a file. You can specifically set exactly what type of permissions that process running in a certain domain has. So,
all right, so I'll talk a little bit about SysTrace. So when Niels Provost first developed SysTrace, the basic observation he made was that any real damage you inflict on a system is through system calls. So let me explain a little bit what system calls are. System calls are essentially a way for a process to instruct the kernel to do something. So for example, one system call is open a file and give me a file descriptor. Another one is write this buffer to this file descriptor. So you can imagine that there's a lot of system calls in an average application. Anything that isn't a system call is really just operating within the protection of the application itself and its memory space. But anytime you, for example, establish a network connection, anytime you do any file system operation, any other system operation are through system calls. And really, that is the only way to inflict damage to the system or to even to escape the control of the process. So that was the basic observation. So one way to do this is to have a policy that defines what system calls you can invoke and how you can invoke them. So for example, one policy entry could be to, you're allowed to use the open system calls, but you're only allowed to specify open on files that are in /temp. You're not allowed to open files that are in /user, for example. So this is essentially what SysTrace is. It's a policy enforcement application that works on system call and the system call arguments. So this essentially gives you very fine-grained access control lists on what an application can do. For example, you can specify anything it can do with a file system, any remote host it can an application can connect to, and so on. And I find that the way the policies are defined, which again are really just a system call and the arguments, it's a very flexible way of defining a security policy. You can use regular expressions, for example, in the system call arguments, and so on. And this is implemented sort of half in kernel, half in userland. So you can imagine you need a certain part of it in kernel to actually enforce strictly the policies that are made. So the way it essentially works is that if you want to SysTrace a process, which is essentially applying these policies to it, or access control lists, if you will, but in the grand scheme of things, it's essentially putting a process in a sandbox of sorts. So the way you do that is first you mark that process for SysTrace, essentially, and the kernel portion of SysTrace will look at any system calls that are made, and if a system call is made by a process that is marked by SysTrace, it'll notify a process running in userland that this system call has just been made with these arguments. What should I do about it? And this is how policies are built, and when you first start using SysTrace, they're built interactively. So anytime you get a policy violation, that is something that's not allowed not allowed in the policy, and also everything is denied by default. So you have to explicitly allow certain system calls and their arguments. So when you get a policy violation, you interactively build this policy. So for example, on my laptop, I'm running essentially every binary under SysTrace, and I've been you know, ever since using it, been dynamically or interactively generating these policies. And, you know, in the beginning, it's been, you know, lots of time creating new policy entries. But now, after maybe 2 years of running with it, you know, it's maybe once a week I get a policy violation, so that I have to add policies. But essentially, what SysTrace boils down to is that it's a mechanism for providing these sandboxing, and it really achieves much of the same that fine-grained access control lists would do. It doesn't allow, I mean, you can't explicitly, for example, tag kernel objects or resources like you would be in a certain other systems. You know, I can't prevent an application from, you know, some data from some application reaching some graphics card driver or things like this, which actually some models allow. But in essence, the observation that was made was any real damage is done through system calls. So we're going to restrict, you know, what you can do with system calls. And it's found to be very effective.
And so I'd like to talk about some of the trade-offs between the two systems. Joe, yes. Okay, so just to repeat, the question was the SysTrace looks at just the bottleneck of system calls and tries to just apply policies there, where SE Linux tries to apply policies throughout the kernel and some of userland, right?
Right.
And the question is, what kind of controls, are there any controls that SE Linux has that don't end up, that are end up being unimplementable in SysTrace? And that's a good question, so I'll let Matt here, who knows more about SE Linux, try to answer that.
Okay. What do you want to do with the SysTrace? Well, one thing that I think it's important to point out is SE Linux, I suppose, does take the idea of system calls, and that's where damage occurs, because throughout the Linux kernel source, in all these system calls or functions called by these system calls, they place these hooks. I would say that it's, in some respects, I could say it's more fine-grained control than SysTrace. In other respects, I'd say it's not. For instance, on reading an inode, for example, a hook is called, and SE Linux is able to determine, based on policy files, whether or not it's allowed. And as I was saying before, as far as granularity, for instance, with reading in typical discretionary access controls or typical Unix permissions, you allow read, for example, or read on a directory. The problem with that is there's actually five different system calls that can be made on a directory with read permission. SE Linux, for example, splits that up, and you can actually allow just one of those system calls on that directory and disallow the other four. So I suppose in that respect, you do get the same granularity as you do with SysTrace, but
you get similar.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the main difference is that you have at least a potential with SE Linux and LSM to track internal kernel objects. So, for example, you could theoretically do things like, you know, I received this network packet from a host I don't trust, and I'm going to tag this packet. It's a bad packet. And if you have some sort of application whose policy is that will not get receive any data from untrusted sources, then it could, for example, deny a read or something from that data source. That's something you couldn't do in SysTrace, but with a system like that, you at least have the potential to explore internal kernel objects too, and things like data origins and destinations and so on. So.
Another thing that SE Linux has over SysTrace is it has, you can essentially do some kind of state tracking in the process via changing of domains. So you can say in SysTrace, there's no way to say after this point in time, these are not allowed. Before that, they are.
Yet.
Marius says yet, which means Niels and Marius probably have it in the pipeline. But in SE Linux, you can definitely allow different state changes and say, before this happens, you're allowed to do it, but after that happens, you're no longer allowed to do that.
And in my talk yesterday, I sort of had a slide about this, and you can allow processes run in specific domains, and you can have them transition. Each domain lists what a process can and can't do, and you can have it, upon some event, transition into another domain where permissions that were allowed in the first domain are no longer allowed in the second domain. And, you know, as Mary said, I guess SysTrace is working on something similar, but I guess that just...
One observation to make is that the domains in SE Linux are very similar to what a policy would be in SysTrace. So policy just defines everything you can do, and changing policies in runtime of a binary, for example, would achieve the state transition. So, for example, you can imagine one good thing about this is, let's say you have SSHD running, and you have some user that comes in and connects to SSHD. And before that user authenticates, you want to be very restrictive in what that invocation of SSHD is allowed to do. However, after the user authenticates, you can relax those restrictions a bit. So that would be one example of where you want this sort of policy state transition.
You have something you want to say there?
No, I think I can just go over with the whole domain transition.
Yep.
Correct. So another interesting trade-off that was made is where the controls are placed. So what does the controlling? For example, in SE Linux, the controlling is mainly done by the kernel, by these hooks. So it's all done in the kernel, and it's all mandatory. There's no way to get around it, and it applies to everything on the system. Whereas a different example is SysTrace, which has a user land process. You can only SysTrace things that you want to trace. You want to SysTrace, and you can leave everything else running without it. So you would only SysTrace things that have the potential to be hacked, and that's a user decision. And this allows for speed. Also, because of that, SysTrace can be put partially in user land. So all of the policy interaction is done via user land. So this is another benefit of SysTrace, but the thing it loses is it loses the mandatory access controls. So there's no way to enforce it across everything in the entire system.
That being said, remember that Unix processes are essentially a big process tree, and if you invoke when you invoke a process and SysTrace it, it also applies to all the child processes. So for example, if you were to SysTrace the user shell immediately after login, you would achieve essentially mandatory access control for that user. It's an interesting one. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's up to the system administrator, and there are plenty of ways to shoot yourself in the foot. You can also permit everything, and really, as a system administrator in both of these systems, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know what access control entries are appropriate in SE Linux, and you also have to know what is and what isn't appropriate, to include in policy files as well as policy transitions in SysTrace.
And as far as running SysTrace from inside of SysTrace, you can apply a policy to the SysTrace binary that says don't let it run or something like that, to prevent someone from trying to change the policy of a running process by doing that. If you, yes, it would. Mario says yes. Correct.
You have anything to say? Not, unless anyone has questions.
Okay, that was a good question. Another interesting trade-off is when you look at policy generation. None of these policies are very easy to generate or understand. When I look at a process, I'm not going to be able to tell ahead of time whether it's going to need to call the ioctl system call or any of the hundreds of possible system calls that are out there. I'm just not that smart. Even for many of the processes that I have written, that doesn't mean I necessarily know what all the system calls they're going to try to call. So generating these policies is an interesting issue. And how do you know if you had a chance at getting it right? And so there's a couple different approaches. The one approach that's available in both systems, for both SE Linux and SysTrace, is to do basically you run the process and you log everything that happens that's possible to be access controlled. Then you go through that log and edit it and say, this needed to call that, so I'll give that permission. This needed to call that, I'll give that permission. This really doesn't need to call that, so I'll deny that. And you can go through the list and try to do that. That's one approach, and it seems to work very well. Both systems use it. Another approach is the SysTrace interactive policy generation, which what it does is every time a system call happens, it pops up a window and gives you the option. You can permit it, you can deny it, you can add a line to the policy that permits it and other things, you can add a line that denies it and other things. And it's very useful for you learn, you can see what's happening as it happens and when it happens, and you can specifically notice. And what a lot of people I know, like Marius was talking about earlier, what he'll do is he'll run his process with a mostly generated policy and leave it running, and most of the time it'll be fine. But every once in a while, something weird will happen, and it'll pop up a window saying, should this be allowed? And he can look at that and say, they're trying to write to Etsy password. I think I'll deny that. Or you can look at it and say, I'm trying to write to a different temp file than I thought. I'll permit that. So it allows him to, gives him a chance to interactively change the policy as needed, and doesn't require you to post-process something afterwards. So these are two different styles of policy generation. And in my opinion, generating good policies is one of the hardest parts. How do you get it both restrictive enough, but yet lets you do everything you want to do?
So I can give a short example of how you do this in SysTrace. There's too much problems. Damn X-Free. So here I just launched a binary that I've never launched before, so it's going to take us from the top. And let's do it. So when you first launch it, and here I don't have any policy for this. I don't know what XSM even is, but it's something in user X11 R6 bin. And here you see you got a policy violation. So it asks me, what do I do? And it's basically saying here it's a system called it's set UGID, and it doesn't have any arguments. So the only option is really to permit it or not. And I can also say, permit this once. I can say deny it and then specify the error code, which it will return. So I'm going to, just go ahead and permit this. So for example, here you see the first interesting one, where it's a file system read. So actually fsread is not a system call. There's another feature of SysTrace, is what's called a system call aliases. So for example, if you do an open with the read flag, you will get an fsread and also various other things. Like for example, if you do the stat, you also get an fsread because you sort of constitute the same thing. So these are just make the policy making a little bit simpler. But here it's asking me, should this process be allowed to read this file var log ld.so.hints, and it should. And now it's asking me other things. I should be able to read these libraries, and considering, for example, that this is an X application, I should probably be allowed to read all the libraries in this in user X11 R6 lib. So you can put in a regular expression saying match this. So it won't ask me about that anymore. And essentially, you know, this is it. And you refine your policy until it sort of fits the bill. And you know, I don't know, there's not much more to say about that. But this is how you generate policies in SysTrace. Martin.
Can you show us the generated policy
plot? Oh, sure. So let's just go through this. I'm just going to blindly, you know, accept everything. This is not what you should do. Yeah, X applications are pain in the ass because they have all these. Yeah, I'm just going to kill it. Great. Just won't die. So actually you can see here, like the total number of lines in all my policies are approaching, you know, 55,000. So you can, it's been two painful years. But for example, we can look at Emacs policy, for example. You see 34 lines is not too bad. So for example, here you see what this looks like, and you can, for example, say it's allowed to read everything in the current working directory, and the current working directory is defined from where you launched the application, or actually where you launched SysTrace. So, for example, if I, you know, Emacs and in source AutoNet, I'll be allowed to read everything under the current working directory, but nothing above it, which sort of makes sense because sort of nice semantics. If there are any other interesting things, for example, you're allowed to exec v find xargs, and well, that's actually so here's an interesting thing actually. So I'm saying that Emacs is allowed to exec v the shell. However, I'm saying the shell will inherit the Emacs policy. It won't use the shell policy. So that means that the shell will be as restricted as Emacs is. Whereas normally, if you just allowed it without the inherit option, it would get the policy of the shell, and that would probably be a bad thing if, you know, someone find an Emacs exploit. I don't know why they would do that, but I guess if you run your mail client or something in Emacs, which I guess a lot of people do. But yeah, this is essentially it. And then all these are sort of special exceptions I've made over the years, I guess. But yeah, it's a pretty simple system, and it works really well. But there is a lot of overhead into generating these policies. So.
You have a question first?
Yeah, go ahead. Like two of them, like name D and something else, I think. It's actually, yeah, there is a project I think called Hairy Eyeball. I don't know why it's called Hairy Eyeball, but it's essentially just a repository of lots of pre-made policies. Now, one thing that's interesting is that you can imagine that some of these are pretty specific to the system you're running on. So there's a lot of sort of targeting you could do. You could, you know, have a set of policies that have certain targeting variables, and you just use M4 or something to generate the real policies.
Yep.
I guess now we're going to see SE Linux.
And as you can imagine, for both of these, they require a lot of knowledge. For SysTrace, you have to know what every system call means to be able to actually decide whether you want to permit it or deny it. And SE Linux requires probably even more knowledge. So I'll let Matt take it.
Okay. Is there anything you can do about that? I'll have to kill X11.
Mario's had the same problem, so I'll just go with it.
It's all right. Apparently my resolution's too high, so it's not going to show correctly on this projector. So what you would be seeing would be an SE Linux policy file. All right. Well, it makes it harder to show if you can't actually... I'd have to kill Xterm then, and...
No, you don't. Hold control.
Control.
Right-click.
Yeah, no.
What term is this?
There it goes.
Large.
Nope.
Try more.
Try to invert it too.
It's like 22 pounds.
Huge.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
That's almost
legible. That's all right.
I think I see an H.
Try to invert it too.
All right.
Can you invert it?
Yeah.
Through here?
On the vertical.
Where is it?
Weeks of preparation went into all of you.
Where is invert? There we go.
The reverse video.
Can you scroll that?
There you go.
Okay.
It takes three hands.
No, I think that's actually worse. All right, let's try that again.
I'll ask a question, actually, while we're waiting. GUI application, obviously. Is there a console application to...
Precisely the same thing.
And what was the context of that user that you were in? Because you could just, like, hit OK. You'd have to, like, type that, like, a password or anything in. Were you, like, user at the time?
No. I mean, like, when you run SysTrace, you run it as a user.
Give him the mic.
So the user is creating... the policy, I mean, I'm creating the policy myself. So that's one mode of operation. The other mode of operation is where the user is not allowed to modify the policies, and you only use system-wide policies. So that would be more, so I mean, like, this is for, you know, personal use, and I'm not part of, you know, it's not a big system that's administered by some central authority, so it's much easier to do this way. But for example, if you have a shell server and you want to sandbox all your users, you definitely don't want them to be able to create policy entries. So you run it in the other mode where you say, you're not allowed to modify the policy, and you can only read from system-wide policy repository. So
to go on expanding that a little bit, the SysTrace, you're not trying to protect an application from yourself. You're assuming that you have rights to do whatever you want. The problem is you want to make sure your application, like your IRC client, doesn't behave improperly. So, and normally it's hard to do that just by running the process. So you run it inside of a SysTrace and you only allowed to do what it's supposed to do. That way, if someone else tries to come in through that process, it's not allowed. So you're not trying to protect it from yourself. You're trying to protect it from doing something it's not supposed to. Yes, you can use it to protect yourself from third-party applications, or you can have the system administrator can force you to use it. But that the general philosophy isn't as strong as mandatory access controls, where even if you have full user rights, that user can only do so much or something. So I'll let Matt talk.
All right. And that's one thing SE Linux doesn't support, is it's not at the discretion of the user. It's completely system enforced, and the system administrator decides what the policies are. So essentially, SE Linux doesn't trust any of its users. As Marius showed, to generate policy files on SE Linux, I guess it could be argued either way whether or not it was more difficult. With SysTrace, you have tons of system calls being made, and you have to deny a whole lot of things or allow a whole lot of things. I mean, is Marius pointed one, the one that he just made was 50,000, was it 50,000 lines long?
Well, that's for every binary app system.
Oh, okay, that's for every, I thought it was one single. SE Linux policy files are relatively small. They're, the largest ones range in about a couple hundred lines. Here's sort of an example of the Apache policy file, and if you... this section here, I can't even read that up there. This section here relates to Apache and what it's allowed to do to its configuration files and what it can do to log files. The first line here essentially just allows any process running in the Apache domain to read Apache config files. That's all it's allowed to do to the file. So if Apache is compromised and it wants to try and overwrite config files, it'll be denied. The next line here, log rotate,
I'm sure you're all familiar with it. It rotates out logs at certain sizes and time periods. This line here says if a log rotate policy file exists, then obviously for log rotate to work, it needs to be able to read Apache config files. So that's essentially what this does. Again, this allows any process running in the log rotate domain to read Apache config files because it needs to learn the location of log files. And if log rotate attempts to execute, and this was what we were talking about before with domain transitions and SE Linux. Here, if log rotate attempts to execute an Apache binary, I didn't write this policy file, so I don't know why log file or log rotate would ever need to execute Apache. But if it does, it leaves the log rotate domain. So this process no longer has the privileges that log rotate does, and it assumes the privileges of the Apache domain. I'll show you another example if I can find it on this huge font. It's a config file. It's not a shell script. So let me search for something. I can't even see my keyboard. Okay. All right. Here's another example of when Apache needs to work with PHP. Any process, or if you execute a PHP script, you don't want this script executing with Apache's permissions. So what this says is if a user attempts to execute a PHP script, or if a PHP script is called, again, it'll leave the Apache domain and transition into a special PHP domain where there's even further restrictions on what it can do. As for policy files, with SysTrace, as Mary has pointed out, there really is no pre-written policy files. With SE Linux, there's a great deal of pre-written policy files. For all the major services, they exist. There's a few, I don't want to say special services, but a few non-popular services where policy files don't exist. The problem with this and with SysTrace is it's more so with SysTrace than SE Linux, but it's fairly not only distribution dependent, but machine dependent. And often it's near impossible to know exactly what legitimate things a user is going to do with a process. So it makes it difficult to write pre-written policy files.
The policy files, if you look at both of them, there's another trade-off that it was made. The SE Linux policy files, like this one, are good examples of they seem to follow more logic. You have these users and domains, and that you transition between domains to change states. It makes a little bit more sense. Whereas SysTrace is a little bit more obtuse in that you're specifying the system trace, the system call policies. But on the other hand, all you have to understand to make a SysTrace policy is system calls and what they do and don't do. This requires a lot more understanding of the whole policy and how SE Linux works to actually be able to write or understand a policy. So there's a trade-off there. There's a lot more learning that has to go on. Most developers are familiar, at least with most system calls. SE Linux has a little more higher learning curve, but a little more logical structure to it.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. The problem with both of them is essentially knowing what should be allowed and what shouldn't. And with SE Linux, a process may try and do something, but there's the possibility that it shouldn't be allowed to do that. And quite often, it's hard to determine if it should be allowed and if it shouldn't. And I imagine with SysTrace, that's also a problem, is knowing what sort of system calls need to be allowed, the bare minimum for privilege. So, yes. It's default deny. So, and that's why SE Linux ships with two different enforcing modes. There's development mode where it tells you what's going to be denied but doesn't actually deny it. and then there's enforcing mode, and because everything is default denied, if a policy file was wrong, let's say the login policy file was wrong for whatever reason, and you are in enforcing mode, there's going to be no way for you to possibly log into the machine. So, yes, default deny.
Are there any safety checks right now for stuff like that? I mean, it'll tell you what's this compulsory, but is it like, shit, you're not going to be able to log in after this?
No, it just... It's actually can be quite difficult to find out what exactly the log message is saying. It SE Linux log messages tell what the process is, what domain it's running on, what operation it's trying to perform, and what the type of that file or resource is. So no, there's nothing. And quite often, doing a simple task will generate pages and pages of log file output, and finding what in there is causing it to be denied can be quite challenging sometimes. Yes?
Yep.
Right, yeah. SE Linux doesn't support enforcing based on the service. It's either all enforcing or not enforcing. And that is a limitation, you know. But, and another thing that is a problem with that is in development mode, when it's not enforcing, it shows you denied messages for every service, regardless of if a policy file exists. So if you can imagine the amount of log files that can be generated when in development mode, it can make it difficult to find which messages are related to your process. There are a few shell scripts that help solve this, but they're not perfect. So, yes. You have to reload the policy file. The policy files are, there's make files for all of them, and you just do a make load, and it'll recompile these. Yeah, you can, yeah. Yes?
So all of the policy files get loaded into the kernel after the boot stage?
Yes. Well, so during the boot sequence.
During the boot sequence, but once you're unusable.
I'm sorry?
Once you're unusable, once it has started running.
No, it... SE Linux also requires a virtual file system, and when all the file systems are mounted, this is one thing SE Linux actually, well, I guess it does take place when init runs. SE Linux requires a lot of user space utilities to be patched. You need a special version of init and system 5 init scripts. You need special versions of bin utils. Because all these files have types, and they wouldn't understand what types and domains are unless they were patched. So during the boot sequence is when policy files are reloaded, so, and it takes a patched version of init to do so. Any other questions?
Overall,
on just this portion, yes.
Oh, I was just
oh.
Go overall, actually, we're out of time.
What's that?
We're out of time.
Oh, we are?
Yeah, we've got like 2 minutes left.
What about Martin?
All right, so, do you have SE Linux profiles, I guess, for common applications like CD, stuff that average users use, root users will also use? Is there any way of describing such that root can copy new kernels into /root?
Yes, that's one thing SE Linux is essentially role-based type access controls, and what it does is every user is given a role, and not only do processes run in domains, but so do users. Typical users just run in the user T domain. This is the least privileged. So if you transition in, there needs to be some sort of super user domain, and otherwise it'd be extremely difficult to administer the system. So root or any user, actually, there's demonstration machines that actually take away root's privileges and give it to another user. This system admin role and the system admin domain has essentially full access control. So, yeah, you can control and you can write new user roles and user domains to offer more control over what users can do. Yes?
How finely grained are the default roles?
They try and offer the least amount of privilege possible, but again, when writing policy files, often it's difficult to tell if a process actually needs that permission. So I would imagine in some policy files there exists.
I mean, default is it come with a root, like a admin role and a user
Yeah, okay, I see. There's by default, there's three roles. There's the user role, there's the staff role, and the system admin role. The user role is the least privileged staff. The only real difference is only users in the staff role can transition into the sysadmin role. The other advantage is SE Linux doesn't allow you to view processes of other users or more powerful users. So users in the staff doesn't have any extra permissions that user doesn't. It's only allowed to transition into the sysadmin role. The other thing the staff role provides is users in the user domain can't view processes of users in the staff domain, and but users in the staff domain can view processes of users in the user domain. So if that kind of...
We are out of time now. Please thank our panelists here. And if... Marius has a fan club. And any further discussions can happen upstairs in the Birds of a Feather room. Thank you.